This week on the Wildlife Herb Podcast, I'm joined by a special guest all the way from North Idaho to talk about a great habitat restoration project he's part of. I think you'll enjoy this episode that we're calling Kootenai River Habitat Restoration Project. If you have any comments, catch us on Facebook. Thank you for listening.
This podcast was a mess.
Welcome back to the Wildlife Herb Podcast. Today we have a special guest, and Jess is not here with us because we wanted to take advantage of having a friend of ours in town to talk about some habitat restoration that he's been working on. So I'm going to introduce Sean Young, and I'll let you kind of give a little background on what you've done, how you got to where you are.
Yeah, thanks, Dallas. For me, all of this started growing up in central Pennsylvania. Up in the coal country there in northern Appalachia. My family, we hunted, we fished, we looked for mushrooms, picked apples, always being outdoors. And over time, that's just what I wanted to be. So I headed towards biology and forestry and fisheries. And I decided to go to a little school out in Wisconsin for environmental studies and learn about all of those things. And then after a couple of years in Wisconsin, got my bachelor's and then ended up in fisheries. And from there, I really did specialize in fisheries and aquatic ecology for most of my career. And then the last 13 years with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, they hired me to be a fish biologist. Being in that department with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, there was a habitat restoration component, a wildlife mitigation component, the conservation aquaculture, and a number of other parts of ecosystem holistic restoration. And I really have always enjoyed that. And I was able to listen to a lot of folks, acquire more expertise. And now I'm the director of that department, and I lead the habitat restoration project. And I still apply my fisheries and aquatic ecology and have a team of other folks, riparian, big game, birds, reptiles, a lot of different components. And so I really appreciate having that portfolio and that diversity now, having my expertise, but I know a lot more now about all the pieces and parts to bring it all together in an ecosystem concept. And so just going to school, Clemson University, went to grad school, and
spent a little time down in Southwest Georgia here doing your work.
So that's my Southeast connection. In Idaho now, was in Idaho before going to Clemson, but I spent 7 years at Clemson in that ecosystem part. As I was doing fisheries and aquaculture, but I helped friends that were doing forestry, deer, turkeys, non-game. Some of my close friends were doing eastern diamondback rattlesnakes, crayfish, burrowing crayfish, general biodiversity. And I always went out and helped them when I could to learn.
Yeah, good.
And so now I've had a pretty diverse career that I kind of just bringing it all together now. Right. And that's where I'm at.
Yeah, nice. It's always good. We talk about it when we have other folks around that it's to have a diverse background, not just sticking with one species or, you know, one type of habitat, I think helps you in managing whatever it is you wind up settling on. You see that broader picture, and nothing's an island unto itself. So if you're managing for a fish or a bird, they're going to be interrelated in some way.
Yes, I agree. Some of us might be on that broader scale across our careers and be applying the science that those basic researchers that have more specialties. Some folks will end up maybe being that and playing their part. And then some folks play that bigger role, bringing all those pieces together and using that synergy on that ecosystem scale. And I'm glad I landed where I am. I enjoy that, bringing the pieces together for a bigger effort. So I'm pretty happy with where I've landed.
We've been up a couple of times and visited since you've been working with the Kootenai tribe and seeing some of the projects y'all are working on. And initially, when we were up there, you were doing a lot of the sturgeon work, so the white sturgeon in the Kootenai River. And that's kind of where I came in looking at some of the project you were doing, the first thing I remember. And so I guess we could kind of start a little bit on what the background or the history is on the river and kind of why where you started with sturgeon and where we're at now.
Yeah, that's a interesting story, and a lot of folks like to hear it. I'm going to relay some of it to you. Thinking about the way I usually relay it in different conferences and venues and meetings with the visuals that we use to tell that story. And so working with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, we try to use the components of the spiritual and cultural significance of the Kootenai Tribe and the General Tanaha Nation, their sister bands on the U.S. side of the border, and then Canada, British Columbia. The Kootenai River is a transboundary river and an ecosystem. It starts in British Columbia, goes south to Montana, hits a mountain range on the west side of the Rockies, goes west into Idaho, hits another mountain range, and goes back north back into British Columbia, where it goes into a very large natural lake, Kootenai Lake, and then goes out to the west through old glacial bedrock formations into the upper Columbia. So
an odd track.
It is. It's a very unique ecosystem. The way it is now crosses all of those modern society, colonial government boundaries. But centrally located, the way the upper Columbia River and the Kootenai curl away and come back to each other almost in a perfect circle, created this very interesting large floodplain intermontane ecosystem that most people don't realize is there. What? However, a long, long time ago, you know, the early peoples into the Americas, the Native Americans found that habitat coming down across the glaciation, post-glaciation, and realized is very productive. A lot of diverse natural resources there for them to take advantage and, you know, settled. And then that was their territory for many, many years. And it was one of the last places in the United States, North America in general, where the Eastern colonization, you know, finally made it out through the West. And then it kind of made it up the West Coast, but it didn't move into that like northern Rocky Mountain area until pretty much sort of the end point of that into the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. And by that time, there had been a series of treaties with the number of the tribes throughout the Northwest. And to this day, some are still not sure what the real situation was. However, in current times, though, they're just moving forward with the situation that times have changed and there's a different future. Right. And as part of that, they have still retained treaty rights to that traditional territory because those natural resources are still very important to them. And they're important to just having them exist into the future for everybody.
Right.
And so after the colonization and the settlers were moving in, they really started transforming the land to make a living, agriculture. So the extensive wetlands were converted, drained, levee systems built. The riparian area was deforested for lumber, but also, again, to make the homesteads for farming, to make that living. And from the early 1900s to say 1960s, that was the dominant change in the land with some of the upland forestry practices. And then in 1974, Libby Dam was completed in Montana. It's a large scale, massive dam in northwest Montana, and it was to create storage capacity to contain floods, provide flood control, and increase the hydropower capacity in the Columbia for more know, folks moving to the Northwest, right. They realized we're going to build a capacity. And that was one of the central projects through the Columbia River Treaty. That reduced flows, changed the thermograph. It changed the nutrient transport. It had been building up from all these changes for decades, over a century. And that was like the nail in the coffin. It just created such a big change on top of the rest that it completely altered the ecosystem.
Yeah. What was the normal flood pulse that you would have seen before the dam?
It was extensive. The Kootenai Valley in Idaho and British Columbia, I would say it's about 75, 80 miles in length, that particular type of annual flood pulse, water on the land, extensive wetlands, permanent lakes in winding sinuous tributaries mixed with, you know, substantial riparian forest that over time, you know, it was so productive. It was part of flyways. The fish were adapting and becoming somewhat specialized to basically it would follow an annual hydrograph of winter would be low flows that usually iced over and minimum flows, and the spring warm up would start to bring extensive snowpack off of all those mountains, and then a substantial flood pulse from historical records was at least 8 out of every 10 years a decade. So it was very stable and repeated, and that entire ecosystem adapted and evolved to it.
Right.
So now that flood pulse is cut, minimized by 50% for flood control of the levee system. And that has had serious ramifications. And the way the water is stored behind that dam changes temperature regimes. And the timing and scale of that flow is also altered by pulsing it in the winter. So when it would be low flows, that's when the energy demand is the highest. So they pulse the water through unnaturally high to create power and sell that at considerable decent market rates. So society using it has kind of flip-flopped the timing and magnitude considerably.
Yeah. Kind of sounds very similar to fire suppression in the longleaf ecosystems down here. Longleaf and fire, you know, it was a regular cycle. You could pretty much count on it occurring on, you know, 1 to 2 years. So all of the species, plants and animals evolved with that type of fire regime. It influenced how they bred and what their habitat was like. And then when we took that away, that changed all that ecosystem, resulted in a lot of threatened and endangered plant and animal species, which is what you're seeing there in the Kootenai River in that basin.
Yes, timing is everything. And then having it at the right scale to support the ecosystem level population abundance and all the interactions, all those components essentially were broken in different ways at different scale than Libby Dam sort of was that large scale final breakage disconnecting all of those ecosystem functions.
Right.
And it's been very difficult for most of those native species, whether aquatic or terrestrial, to cope with that.
Right. Right, to change their ecosystem. And one thing we see when we're out there is there's a lot of diking that was done along the river to further help reduce the flood issues so that they could have agricultural fields that weren't flooded or the homes that were in those areas that were flooded. So that's changed how you were able to restore that ecosystem too, is having those dikes in place.
Yeah, that's a big component of the current situation is the reality to maintain support for habitat restoration. There's still the needs of modern society and private landowner rights. And the Kootenai tribe respects that. And so we have a group of folks, consultants that are specialists in designing and basically modeling flows and outcomes if you engineer levee removals and reconfiguration and the re-landscaping of some of those areas where we can do that without damaging infrastructure or imposing on some of the landowners.
Right.
And so we put a lot of effort into, is there potential? If there is, would folks like to get on board? And then it is strategically re-engineered for the best reestablishment of ecosystem functions and transport of the water on into the in restored wetlands and then off to feed the river to recharge that ecosystem. That's one of the main considerations. And that's one of my main duties now is to juggle that balance and keep people on board and in support and strategically do what we can, where we can, the best way we can.
Right.
Yeah.
And so before we go into some of the details on how y'all are, you know, attempting to restore some of this ecosystem, let's talk about some of the species that are being impacted. I guess, specifically, I already mentioned sturgeon, but you've got burbot and some other species that are in decline. So you want to talk a little bit about some of those and what you're looking at doing?
Yes, the sturgeon are the most well-known part of the story. The sturgeon are spiritually significant to a lot of the Columbia River tribes, in particular the Kootenai tribe of Idaho and the Tanaha Nation inland. Being such long-lived and of large size, they have held a special place for millennia now. When those folks settled into North America, it became part of their spirituality and their culture, and they hold them with high regard. So it's very important. So they've been that centerpiece. However, they're just one of a suite of species, aquatic and terrestrial, that have undergone significant decline. The southern mountain caribou were extirpated, I think, three times now. Folks have tried to reestablish the mountain caribou in Idaho, Montana, and Northeast Washington several times, and it's just not working anymore.
Right.
With the forestry practices, the old growth gone, the predator balance, and just the number of habitat changes, even at the highest altitudes, elevations up there in the mountains, mountain caribou are gone from
right. The
lower 48 U.S. They're in severe decline in British Columbia as well. So sturgeon down at the bottom, in the river, in the valley, to the whole way to the top, there's been a whole suite, wolverines, lynx, at one point grizzly bear, the extirpation and removal of the wolves, and down to the fish in the river. From top to bottom, there's been a lot of changes. So that's why we have a lot of different components and trying to piece that all back together. But sturgeon were the centerpiece. Back in the 80s, once Libby Dam was constructed, some of the state agencies continued to do the post-dam monitoring, and they were not seeing recruitment of the younger fish. And sturgeon, again, was the one that really was very obvious and highlighted. Kootenai tribe were very concerned about that, but they were still in a different state of transition from the past to the future. But they're like, this is important. And they proposed to Bonneville Power Administration, who oversees the power grid and distribution of mitigation through the Columbia Basin, to start conservation aquaculture for white sturgeon, which was also just kind of starting as scientists came over from Russia and some of the European countries. But then the Kootenai tribe were pretty adamant this was an important part of their culture and spirituality. So it came about in the late 80s, and folks got trained, started building. And since the late 80s, the Kootenai tribe has really been at the forefront of sturgeon, burbot, general ecosystem restoration, and how to scale up in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
So that's more of the history of that cultural, spiritual, in a modern society, and then having to find the funding and the right and having the proper mechanisms in place to make that a reality. It's all kind of, a fairly unique story. And that's usually what we talk when we go to conferences and meetings and on radio and, talking to you today.
Yeah. It's a really neat process. And it's amazing to see them go from, the small little egg to this enormous fish. long-lived species. So what's a little bit about the life history, I guess, of sturgeon for those who may not know?
With sturgeon, they have a very long evolution. Sturgeon and the sharks, rays, cartilaginous fish, they're from the oldest lineages back to 300, 350 million years now. Way back then, when fish were starting to speciate and spread more across the planet, they were generally more armored fishes, and then they were growing in size with different habitat over the eons. And then, you know, as major shifts in the planet occurred, those fish were waning. So the sturgeons and the sharks and rays are the remnants of those older lineages of the fish. So sturgeon have a lot of bony projections still, scutes, right, and armored skull. And that's all the remnants of their ancestors, those bony armored fishes. So they have been around for a very long time.
They're living dinosaurs.
Yes, they have outlasted the dinosaurs and a lot of other groups of animals. Even as the plate tectonics moved across the earth, the sturgeon were able to reinvade a lot of different habitats and just continue to hold on. And one reason is they are long-lived. It is confirmed that they can live to over 100 years, so they can attain large sizes. They're one of the largest freshwater fish on Earth, with some of the other sturgeons being the largest. And it's just that longevity. And they also are known to have one of the lowest stress responses when they're being handled and cultured. I think that is part of it, is that they just have this strategy of, we're just going to last a long time. We're not going to stress out about anything, and we're going to outlast whatever to just continue on.
Right.
So they actually caviar. They have large eggs, and with their big body size, they have a lot of eggs. Most fish either have a lot of small eggs or fewer large eggs. Sturgeon have large eggs in large quantities because of their large size. So that also gives their offspring a better chance right from the beginning. I think that is a important part of how they can persist.
Right.
And they generally spawn late spring, early summer, about 14 degrees, and generally in mid to upriver areas with good flow and good clean substrate. But they then in turn have a fairly short incubation of only 7 to 10 days, which is quite short for cold water, freshwater fish. So then it's all about timing. You take our burbot, who spawn in the dead of winter and then have a long incubation until the spring warm up. Sturgeon decide we're going to spawn in the late spring when it's already warm and have a short incubation. So all these species have their own way of having the timing that meets that natural annual cycle. So sturgeon have that unique capacity that seems to have done well everywhere.
And what they're, I guess, with all the species, the goal is to get their fry out there when the nutrients that they need to grow are in the water.
Yes. Get your eggs in a good place so you can incubate, have good embryo development, then hatch at the right time so those little ones, because they're going to be on their own. Most fish don't have any parental care. So the parental care is, we just put you in the right place, the right time, and everything works out. And then it all just works after there. And you have a lot of these early life transitions from hatch, free embryo, to absorbing the yolk sac when their organs are still developing, even though they've hatched out. And then when that mouth gut is all in proper form, ta-da, you got to have something to eat. And don't be eaten while you're trying to find something to eat. So they're trying to find cover while trying to find food, and they just have that balance. And fish have a very high natural mortality. Putting a lot of eggs out, somebody survives.
Right.
So it's a numbers game with almost all fish. And over all those years, somebody has always survived.
Right.
That's some of the major concern, is that over the last 100 years, we have broken things to the point where they cannot persist without our assistance after all those millions of years of doing so. We have altered things that drastically in just that period of time.
Yeah, that says a lot for a species that survived all that millennia to now we rely on humans to persist. So that really speaks to what those changes are. So what are some of the changes, I guess, that they're experiencing? I know some of it's, you know, nesting substrate. Some of it has to do with, you know, the food availability once they hatch. So we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good conversation. Say 20 or 30 years ago, the original recovery actions were centered around trying to get the adults to put the eggs in the best habitat that folks thought was typical sturgeon spawning habitat. The Kootenai wild adults don't necessarily put the eggs. They don't spawn where you think they should. They're spawning down in the floodplain, meandering part of the river, instead of moving up into the higher velocity, cleaner substrate. And that doesn't match what most sturgeons do. But nobody knows for sure exactly what was their strategy before all these changes. So the plan was, can we provide them some better cues for them to want to move into what was thought to be better spawning? Put the eggs in a better habitat to start this, the life cycle, but that was going to be the solution. So for 20 years, everybody did that with very good plan and considerable resources. However, that did not solve the problem, and we're left with still a big question mark. Over that time, the other parts of the program came about and have expanded to where there's a general consensus that understands we can't just reconnect one little piece here and one there thinking it's going to solve all the problems.
Right.
We have that true ecosystem concept now saying to get these animals through all these life stages, we have to have an intact ecosystem. We can't just fix a couple things and think it's all going to be better. That lesson has been taught and I think acknowledged.
Yeah. You have to meet the needs of the species at all times of the year. And a lot of species, that changes from season to season, month to month, or whatever. And if there's one little piece missing, the whole thing falls apart.
Yes, and that's even getting to be more difficult because of climate variability, the influx of folks moving to the region, that creates more demand on the hydropower system. And with climate variability and water, precipitation. We're now 2 years of low precipitation. That's going to affect storage and discharge through the hydro system, which changes electric output. So when those societal priorities have to be placed first due to the changes in the environment, that it really starts changing the habitat because now you're operating that system different. So we changed it for the general long-term pattern of these regions. And when we have to change it again to meet societal demands, it's almost like starting over with a blank slate of now, how are we changing it? And now how is it affecting all these? Because we just spent 20 or 30 years following what was happening. And now there's a new situation starting to come about. And that's a challenge in itself, is keeping up with the times of how are things changing again or more. And it can be taxing, like, well, we just spent all these resources and these plans and we have to come up with new plans because the world's changing so fast and it's hard to keep up with that.
Right. So now not only are you having to think about how to fix what's happening now, you're having to look forward and maybe guess at what the changes will be in the future. Things you didn't think about 20, 30 years ago are happening.
Yes, and that's getting more and more difficult. However, you know, adaptive management, that is a big deal.
Right.
And that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I would say most situations, they're all going to be unique depending on which region, which ecosystem, or what part of that ecosystem it's so intricate, and we've disrupted it in so many ways, and those things are all changing. Yeah, that is a difficult one. Adaptive management is going to be key, but boy, it is complicated. Yeah.
We don't have a crystal ball, unfortunately, so we can't predict what's happening and see the future. Hopefully we can learn from the past. But one thing that stands out with, and it's not just that region, but a lot of regions, is there's a thought out there that if we just let Mother Nature continue and step back, you know, she's going to take care of everything. But we've disrupted all the processes that Mother Nature had. So without our help, she can't manage what's there.
Yeah, at this point, our presence is still so significant. Blending that with Mother Nature, I would say you're just kind of, you know, banging heads. Right. You know, it's a concept more than, you know, us
right.
two people banging heads. But that concept of trying to control everything, we can't control it. And there's a reality of what we're doing. So, yeah, I agree that at this point, it really has to be a blend of modifying what we do, seeing what that large concept Mother Nature reaction is at that to us. That's the ultimate scale at this point right. in our existence. And trying to figure out that balance of, you know, where can we re-engineer? What can we do on certain time scales to bring back into balance? And then how much is that going to cost? What is the capacity to do that? Is society supporting that? Because without all that, there's been a lot of effort put into changing this world the wrong direction. It's going to take a lot to change it back into a sustainable balance. And I really think that's where everybody's at right now is what is that? And what is it going to cost? And how do we build capacity to try that?
Yeah.
I think it's daunting for me. I just see it as a challenge and like a new experiment.
Yeah.
And let's give it a try. Because if we don't, you know, I don't like the potential outcome of that. So
it's a marathon. Some people want to think, you know, that it's going to happen overnight, that we just go out there and wave a magic wand and fix it. But, you know, if it took 50, 100 years to get to this point, it's probably going to take the same amount of time to repair it. But the problem is we're causing more issues as we go along. And so that's where the public's going to really have to be on board with it. I know a lot of people are, we think we're all on board for conservation until it causes us some sort of discomfort. Like, you know, you don't have your power at the low rate you want it to be, or, you know, in that situation, or, you know, maybe an area floods more than you would like it to at the wrong time of the year. And so we can't have everything.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, even for it's like adaptive for me as a professional, being back in the Southeast, I now think about it's been 400 plus years of change, and there's even more people back here. That's even bigger challenge of what I'm facing out in that ecosystem. It's like, wow, like 20 years ago, I never thought about things right. like that. And now I do. And it's like, that's a big challenge. I'm glad folks are interested in longleaf pine restoration, some different river conservation and projects and fish passage, endangered species work. And then I think about all of the different obstacles and the permits and all of the things that go into trying these. And then all of that on top of what I do, it's like, wow.
It's daunting.
Yes, I respect and appreciate those that are trying to do the same back here in the East and Midwest.
Yeah, it comes down to, it doesn't matter where you are. We're all headed towards the same goal of some sort of habitat restoration and improving things for the future, trying to save these species. So y'all have a plan, some things you're trying. Where are you at now, and kind of what are you looking at hoping to do to restore some of this ecosystem?
That's a good question. I think the lesson learned is habitat, habitat, habitat. We'll keep doing some of the base components since like sturgeon and burbot and some of the other fish still aren't recruiting. We'll still artificially put those age classes and have consistent year class recruitment via the hatchery. Try to manipulate some of the fish structure through management and conservation strategies. However, we really need to make sure the habitat is there for those fish to grow fast enough to mature, to be that adult spawning potential, to take advantage of the habitat. We generally were ahead of that, so we're also playing catch up to get that habitat to the place where those fish can take advantage and that reproductive potential can really take off for a self-sustaining population. So to do that, that's just one example. But also, if you're going to try mountain caribou again, if you're going to do wolverine and lynx recovery, again, from top to bottom, habitat, 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 we have to concentrate on that. So that's the focus for the future, is maintaining those species that are in decline or extirpated, bring them back, maintain them. We just got to keep putting most of our effort into the habitat. That means working with the water managers, the land managers, your waterfowl specialists, your foresters, or, you know, all the components, because of that habitat complexity, trying to bring back the complexity.
It's kind of a field of dreams scenario, hopefully, that if you build it, they'll come.
Yes.
So you're working on building. So just from, you know, a sturgeon or burbot standpoint now, what are some of the habitat alterations that y'all are working on?
Some of the big concepts now, breaching the levee system strategically. The Kootenai Tribe of Idaho was able to purchase a private property in the floodplain, and that was the showcase, using the Bonneville power mitigation money and then restoring that, breaching the levees for that specific property without infringing on other folks, and restoring that floodplain with water management, particularly in the higher snowpack years, more water, more flexibility for everybody. We were able to actually reconnect and have transport onto and off of that land again. Using conservation aquaculture and some of our other components, we put fish strategically in there at different life stages and some other actions, and we showed how important those habitats were to those organisms. We had outstanding survival of the burbot in particular at the earliest life stages. And not only did they survive, they ended up growing 2 to 3 times faster through their life than the ones we were keeping in the hatchery to older juveniles. And we were spending a considerable amount of time and money really taking care of those and creating quality fish. But we learned that lesson. If they have the natural setting, the better natural diet, they're just on a different track of potential the rest of their life. And so now we're learning from the fish, bird surveys, amphibian surveys, even just the big game surveys, more grizzly bears showing up, unique visits by some of these severe decline big game coming back down into the valley, using them as travel corridors from one mountain to the next. They've learned to avoid and stay out of conflict with some of the private landowners because they now have a corridor that wasn't there. So the importance again of just the habitat, habitat, habitat. Eventually, a lot of these animals are finding it and realizing the potential. So in terms of grizzlies, it's great to have a place to help them stay out of conflict.
Yeah.
Because that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And trying to keep community support to have a sustaining grizzly bear population in an area with a growing human population.
Right. Yeah. A lot of those big predators and population, human populations don't get along too well. So it's good to have a place for them to survive and not interact as much.
Yeah, they learn quick. You know, and respecting animals for the intelligence that they have and utilizing that intelligence, understanding how they're thinking and what the cues are and what they need. I feel strongly that if you respect that, you definitely can use that to the advantage. And those animals usually respond in a very positive way.
Yeah. They don't want to be in an artificial environment, so they're going to gravitate towards those more natural ecosystems that are more like what they evolved in.
Yeah, generally, most of the animals only respond if they're put in a bad situation or they don't have the means to survive, and then they're desperate.
Right.
They can stay out of desperate situations just like a human or an uncomfortable situation they did not intend to be in. You know, generally stay out of conflict.
Yeah.
So having those areas is showing that if you can do that, positive results.
Yeah. I think it's neat that, you know, if you're trying to restore a riparian area, you know, a riverine ecosystem, but it just builds up into those higher class animals, you know, your carnivores, all of that just builds in on itself, and you improve that overall ecosystem for all species involved from bottom up. So that's one thing a lot of people, I think, don't realize is you're not just managing for one species. Maybe sturgeon, or for me would be bobwhite quail, or kind of our poster child, is something people are familiar with, they're interested in. And by managing for them, you benefit a whole suite of other species as well. Some of them people don't even realize are there, plants and animals that people ignore, but they still benefit.
I agree with that. Another consideration is the relationship out of the tribal programs to all the other government agencies. Our society tends to compartmentalize things, you know, Forest Service, Soil Conservation, Fish and Wildlife Service. If you're on a refuge, well, then it's waterfowl. If you're in a different part of Fish and Wildlife Service, it could be different specialties. Just talking with them in that relationship about not pigeonholing and being open-minded to using all of their resources in a more integrated way as well. Kootenai Tribe, we're doing that, and it does take a lot of work, but asking them, could you learn from this also? It's a lesson to be learned. Instead of staying compartmentalized,
right,
starting to bring all those resources together in a better synergy for a more holistic. I know that's going to be a lot of work.
Oh, yeah, but an integrated approach works a lot better.
Sure. From the amount of investment and all of the human capital, that's the wave of the future, is trying to find ways to do that and sort of shift some of the structure and bureaucracy to be more integrated.
Yeah. Because you can't manage, like we said before, for just one part of it and expect, you know, the whole ecosystem to return or to be able to return a species, because you're missing some component in there. Backing up to, you know, what you were talking about with some of the restoration projects, and you've cut the dikes to allow some of that flood pulse back in on the property that the tribe has. The purpose of allowing that flood pulse back in, correct me if I'm wrong, is that nutrient flow, which allows a lot of the zooplankton, phytoplankton, which are the base of the food chain, and then feeds all these little fish that allows them to grow. And so that's, you're starting that basis by putting that nutrient back into the system, right?
Yes, that is one of the major components of the portfolio. When Libby Dam was completed, it's a deep, elongated reservoir at the headwaters, essentially. So as the Rocky Mountains and the other local mountain ranges have, you know, they erode, that was all glaciated. So there's a lot of glacial deposit already, that real fine flour. That's where most of the phosphorus was coming from. So because that glacial till, that flour is so fine, it is transported into water. It's buoyant. And as that was coming down from the headwaters in mass, it settles in the river valley. As that velocity reduced, all that was being deposited year after year, decade after decade. And that phosphorus was very important to aquatic ecosystems, and that was the transport. So when Libby Dam was put in there, it reduced the flow velocity 60 miles too far upriver. So all that glacial till settled and is filling the reservoir. And like only 2% of the phosphorus that should be coming down to the ecosystem, only like 2% still comes through Libby Dam. And that had another huge ramification. Phosphorus kickstarts aquatic ecosystems. It has to be in balance with nitrogen. Your terrestrials are the opposite. But regardless, you have to have a good nitrogen-phosphorus balance. for cellular metabolism, for photosynthesis. The algae need it to absorb the sunlight and kickstart all of, like I said, the food web. That was all broken as well. So we have a program to try to kickstart that at the bottom of the food chain. By putting water on the landscape again, you shallow the water, you get more sunlight. If you have the nutrients, now sunlight for photosynthesis, the proper nutrient, chemical balance, algae proliferate, and the zooplankton then can warm up. They have food to eat, and they start also reproducing. And then you have your algal blooms. And the little fish need all that to eat, and they survive, they grow. And then some of the bigger fish eat the little fish. You know, everybody's eating everybody. That is generally broken throughout that ecosystem, and we're just now starting to piece it back together at some scale to see some positive results.
Yeah. And what we've talked about, you know, a lot of the animals, but one thing we didn't talk about was, you know, a lot of the plant species that are missing from this ecosystem now too. Some of the plants in the aquatic, when it floods, that's hiding places for the little fish, but you're also missing a lot of the trees. And so you're working on restoring some of that too, right?
Yes. From your sedges, your rushes, your willows, the cottonwoods, trying to recreate that plant assemblage also from the little parts to the bigger trees. It was all broken. It was all just drained, deforested, and wheat is the predominant crop. So I just wanted soil that was very productive and just wheat, you know, year after year after year.
Okay.
So one of the issues we also have is some places don't farm anymore. And when they left it go fallow, there's certain grass species that now dominate all of that habitat. And they have a lot of mechanisms to deter all the other plants from coming in there. They're really great at monoculturing and proliferating. And now we're trying to figure out ways to overcome that. And that was another lesson learned that I don't think anybody expected.
Yeah. These invasive species are good at what they do, but the native species didn't evolve with them there, so they can't utilize them. Like you said, they outcompete everything that they do need. And I think you know, putting the trees back on the landscape, part of that was some of that temperature regulation as well.
Yeah, temperature regulation is definitely a big deal, especially if the climate's going to warm. But also, when those plants either drop leaves or die and decay, that was a huge carbon source.
Yeah.
Because you need nitrogen and phosphorus, but you also need carbon. Carbon is the base of all of the basic complex molecules and carbohydrates. And without all that, it's pretty carbon starved as well. So yeah. We really were focusing on nitrogen, phosphorus, and in doing that, started to realize how carbon starved it was as well. It's better to use those natural carbon sources to get that in balance. And so we're really hoping the plants will help balance the nitrogen and phosphorus uptake, some of the contaminants issues. And then as they die and decay, they become the natural source of carbon. And we just get that cycling going to keep it in balance, and it just perpetuates, and it would just build momentum.
Right. If you can restore all that natural cycle, then it's also cheaper.
Yes.
Because you're not having to pay to put those inputs in, and it works better.
Yes. So you have the physical habitat for the animals, all the insects, that structure, then the shade, but also all that carbon input. And you just have all those multiple benefits that if it can perpetuate on itself, yeah, you don't have to worry about the capacity and all the expense of trying to provide all those services. They just start doing that for you once again.
Yeah. It's a really neat project. And I thought it was great that there's a lot of private landowners around the area that are very interested in seeing this ecosystem restored. Even though it may mean flooding a portion of the area at a certain time of the year, it's obviously not for the whole year, but they're willing to do that, to modify that landscape.
Yes. At the onset, there was some reluctance, you know, the focus being an endangered species. What does that mean for my rights?
Right.
You know, the endangered species regulations. Well, also, you know, what does that mean for the future of what I can do? How can I still sell? Like, what agreements?
Right.
And I think over time, the community saw that that wasn't the intent to regulate anybody. It's right. just the general consensus of the tribe and most of the people that live there. And I think most of the places in the world is that this is an important part of our heritage, regardless of who you are. We want it to still be there in the future. And people were noticing, you know, you just don't see as many elk. You don't see as many right. of this and as that. And it's just not the same. And even if you were a naysayer, you see that situation long enough, people were recognizing, you know, there is a issue here. And there's a lot of support because in the end, it is important. People want to fish. People want to hunt. People just want to see animals. They just want to see natural beauty. They want to get away from it. And that's becoming more and more valuable and important. Yeah. So they're on board, and trying to figure out that balance is a key component, and just reassuring them that there are considerations and there's modern society, and we present them with ideas and what could be possible. And that went a long way. Folks before me started that. I lead it now. So it was a real good foundation. It started off with a good reputation for cooperation and understanding. And I just try to maintain that at this point. And
yeah.
it went a long way and has really helped build that momentum.
Yeah, I think it's probably was very important that this wasn't really shoved down anybody's throat. It's all been a voluntary thing. You know, you've seen where the tribe has done it on property they have, how it works, and then, you know, offering it to someone instead of saying you've got to do this is probably one reason you get a little better buy-in too.
Yes, people came to the middle ground, which is difficult.
Yeah.
In our current society, 20 and 30 years ago it was pretty difficult, but people did do that.
Yeah.
There was, if we avoid litigation, we will. If you show general support. And people on the other end said, yeah, you know, we are concerned about individual rights and endangered species being imposed, the regulations. However, it is important. We'll come to the middle. Don't impose. Okay, that's great. We won't litigate. And by coming to the middle, you can do really great things because you avoid litigation. You avoid the opposition. And it's cheaper. It's more effective. And you can just get better results. Instead of digging in, even the politicians came to the middle. And when everybody was able to come to that middle ground, regardless of your politics, your background and beliefs, even religion, it's a pretty unique mix. Without that, though, the program wouldn't be where it is. That yeah. was before me. So again, I just inheriting a situation that people worked really hard to get there. And just try to maintain that trust and that cooperation.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. So we're pushing up close to an hour now. So I usually kind of wrap up with a question. Why is this project and the habitat restoration you are doing, why would this be important to the general public? Why should they care?
I think about that a lot. And I have a couple of different perspectives that I'll share. The first is I think about who I work with, the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho. Native Americans that had to go through a lot of experiences, genocide, marginalization, a huge change from what they used to be to what things are now in a very short period of time, depending on where they live. And nature is still that central part of who they are to move forward and think about the past. That seems to be similar to my personality is, even going through whatever life experience, nature has always kind of been that thing that holds it together. And I think people are starting to realize that, whether you're Native American or not, it just seems to be something that can help keep you on a path or heal and all that. And realizing as mental health issues become more and more important, work-life balance, nature is a big part of that.
Right.
And without that, it's really hard to maintain, even in a modern society, health. So by having a healthy nature, it's becoming more important. We can stay healthier as well.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just on a lot of levels of importance of what nature, the natural world, still provides to us. Even with all of our science and technology, it's still the core part of us in so many ways that maybe everybody was getting away from. And now it's trying to reevaluate how important that is. And then equity, inclusion, doesn't matter. You know, people are people, no matter. And in the end, a lot of things come down to the same for every one of us. And the importance of nature, I feel, is one of those.
Yeah. There's been a lot of studies that have shown, and we've talked about that in another podcast, was that how being out in nature really improves your health, your mental well-being. So it's great.
So I guess setting a precedent or having a story to show that example, to share with folks, it really is one of the highlights of my career. Having a voice with something good to talk about and talk about how to somehow hold this together and have a future.
I appreciate it because this is a really neat project. I've enjoyed learning about it and seeing some of it come to fruition, and excited to see how things move forward in the future. And appreciate your time and telling us about it. And hope everybody enjoys it as much as I did.
Thank you.
Yep. All right. Well, that'll wrap us up for this episode, and we appreciate y'all listening in and hope you join us next time. Thanks.